They come from the bowels of hell.
The Dana Gould Hour.
Jungle worms and swamp rats run around your feet.
I bought a dog that killed a calf that ate the canary. What is truth?
And once again, welcome back.
It is a cruel, cruel summer, as Bananarama sang, or as we call them, the Bananarammers. Thank you. Winston Churchill once said, "You can always count on America to do the right thing after it's exhausted every other option." And we are certainly taking that approach with the pandemic. And so, as we continue to struggle through this mess, who better to guide us through it than the bitter Buddha himself, Eddie Pepitone? Eddie has his own daily podcast called Live from the Bunker, and he has a new special called For the Masses, which is on Amazon Prime. It is outstanding. I know. I was at the taping. And of course, it was filmed back when you could do that sort of thing. Although we are not going back to the old setup of the show, we do have a second interview for this episode. Chris Condon, a friend of mine, has an excellent graphic novel that just got released called That Texas Blood, and Chris is here to talk about it. I wanted to mention, before we got into the show, two very dear people that we've lost since the last episode, one being Carl Reiner. Carl was a legend in American comedy. I did not know Carl Reiner. I never met the man. But I do know his comedy partner and longtime friend, Mel Brooks. Whenever Carl's name came up, and it came up every day, because they literally saw each other every day, Mel would often say, quite simply, "A very great man." Indeed. Carl was born in the Bronx, and he served in the Army in World War II. He trained to be a French interpreter, and after years of successfully learning French, the Army sent him to Hawaii, where he was to work as a teleprinter operator, which is how the Army does stuff. Now, the Army also has a branch called the Special Services, which is dedicated to troop morale, putting on shows and plays, etc. While in Hawaii, Carl auditioned for a play and was spotted by an English officer who was also in the Special Services, Major Maurice Evans. Yes, that Maurice Evans, who would go on to play Dr. Zaius in Planet of the Apes, Crazy Small World. Major Evans saw to it that Carl Reiner was transferred into the Special Services. That is so weird to me. What did he do in World War II? Hamlet. Anyway, after the war, Reiner got out of the Army, stayed in New York, was cast in several Broadway shows, and eventually joined the cast of the TV show Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows, which was Saturday Night Live of its day, only bigger. There were only two or three channels back then. Sid Caesar was as big as you could get. Now, the writing staff for Your Show of Shows was, among other people, Mel Brooks, Larry Gelbart, Neil Simon, a kid named Woody Allen. I mean, it's insane. Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks teamed up as a duo and performed regularly on The Steve Allen Show. And one of their continuing pieces was The 2,000-Year-Old Man. Reiner had a great life in the late 1950s. He lived in Connecticut and commuted into New York City every day to write for television. Like Don Draper, without the booze, infidelity, and stolen name. Remember, Don Draper is really Dick Whitman. So Carl created this sitcom based on his life called Head of the Family. The network liked the show, but they didn't like Reiner in the lead, so they recast it with an up-and-coming comedic actor named Dick Van Dyke, whose real name, of course, is Penis Van Lesbian. Thank you! A young actress named Mary Tyler Moore played Van Dyke's wife, and the Dick Van Dyke Show became a long-running television classic. Carl was a writer, an actor, a director, a producer. He was also a husband and father to, among others, actor and director Rob Reiner. Once on The Tonight Show in the late 1960s, Johnny Carson asked Carl who the funniest person he knew was. Now, everyone expected Carl to say Mel Brooks. But instead, Carl said, "My 13-year-old son Rob has a friend named Albert Einstein, believe it or not, and that kid may be the funniest person I know." Albert Einstein was the son of radio comedian Harry Einstein and would later in life change his last name to Brooks. Carl never stopped. In the late 70s and early 80s, he directed the Steve Martin movies The Jerk, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Man with Two Brains, All of Me. Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, by the way, very underrated movie, even though it was critically acclaimed at the time. Carl wrote over 24 books and was active on Twitter up until the day he passed away, June 29th, 2020. He was 98. I wanted to talk about one other person who was also close to Mel, and in this case, close to me. Stuart Kornfeld also left us far too young and far too early. Stuart was a California boy born in Tarzana in 1958. He attended the American Film Institute, and while he was there, he worked in a director's workshop with Anne Bancroft, which led him to becoming an assistant to Mel Brooks on High Anxiety in 1977. He continued to work with Mel. Stuart was a really cool guy. He was married to Joanna Wendt, who was a performance artist and one of the originals of the LA punk scene in the late 70s. She performed frequently at The Mask. Stuart had an amazing mind. He introduced Mel Brooks to a young director named David Lynch, who at the time had only made one movie, Eraserhead, but thanks to Stuart, David would then go on to make the Mel Brooks-produced The Elephant Man. A few years later, Stuart would work on the David Cronenberg-directed Mel Brooks-produced The Fly. In 1999, he teamed with Ben Stiller to create Red Hour Films, Ben's production company. I'm not sure if this is public knowledge, and I hope I'm not divulging anything top secret, but Ben is a giant Star Trek fan, and Red Hour is a nod to the episode Return of the Archons. Anyway, Stuart and Ben made Zoolander, Duplex, Starsky and Hutch, Dodgeball, the Tenacious D movie, Blades of Glory, Tropic Thunder. I was fortunate enough to be involved in a lot of those titles, thanks to both Ben and Stuart, for which I am very grateful. I saw Stuart last year when he attended one of the shows that Bobcat Goldthwait and I were doing at the Bell House in Brooklyn. I knew he'd been sick, but I assumed it was in his past because he looked great. He was absolutely 100% his normal, brilliant, funny self. He was great, but cancer is cancer, and I wish he was still here. Stuart Kornfeld, the best. So, as I say, it's a cruel summer, but on we go. Hakuna Matata and all that. As Elvis Costello sang in one of my favorite songs, Tokyo Storm Warning, we're only living this instant, and so it's on to our filthy business. Lastly, before we go, please allow me to say a word about our Patreon feature. We have one. It's simple, and I hope you sign up. $5 a month gets you the title Dana Gould Hour Sky Cadet. And for that, every month, you get a bonus interview segment, you get some video content, etc., etc. This is a special show, and our Patreon reflects that. We don't have graded levels. For $25, I'm not going to come to your house and shampoo your dog. For $5, you're a Sky Cadet, you get some stuff. So go to danagould.com for details. And off we go. Now, Ed.
Yes.
When I think of you, I think of the phrase, sunny side of the street. That's where you're walking. When I sit down to do an interview, I always wonder, God, I hope there's enough stuff here. I hope there'll be enough stuff to fill out the hour. I'm not worried about that with you today.
Oh, my God. Yeah, man. I mean, I'm just here. I have other friends who were like texting me things like, hey, looks like there might be another pandemic
in China, coming from China. Yes.
Of all places. Yeah. Who would have guessed another one from China?
Yeah. Who would have guessed a grossly overpopulated nation with no governmental controls on pollution would produce?
Yeah. Yeah. And who eat any animal that has ever walked the earth,
and any part of any animal. I was at I was at a buffet in China and walked by a big bowl of chicken feet. I'm not lying. And I said to the guy next to me, "Oh, that's too bad. I had chicken feet for breakfast." And he was like, "Were they good?" It's like, "Shut the fuck up."
Yeah, it is amazing. And well, one thing they've taught me, though, the pangolin, I am now raising pangolins in my tub. I'm raising pangolins in my tub. Yes, in my tub. They like water. They like porcelain. I raise them, and then I extract from their eyes a liquid that I then sprinkle on my food. And I don't know, so far I've been lucky with the pandemic. I don't feel bad, but raising pangolins is something that I've gotten out of this whole thing.
Yeah. Your goal is to be more COVID than man.
Yeah. But it is really scary because now I'm understanding a stat I read is that 1 in 140 people in LA have this thing.
Yeah.
Which is a lot.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, mm-hmm. you know, this whole period of time, and we haven't even gotten into the sort of the racial reckoning, which is.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Because I won't watch a movie if it doesn't have blackface in it. So I'm up the creek right now.
I know I've had to take down the picture I have in front of my house of Al Jolson.
Yeah, or the 27x41 A sheet for the C. Thomas Howell film Soul Man. But
Songs of the South.
Songs of the South, right. In fact, yeah, they renamed, they're doing something to the ride at Disneyland.
I heard about
that. Which is weird because I've been on that ride 100 times. And I would have
Well, it says a lot about you.
I think so. Well, they give you these white robes to keep clean, to keep dry. but it's just, I don't know what they're going to change because it's a water. It's just, you're going down. Have you ever been on it? You're in a big,
In
a big inner tube with seats on it. You know, it's a industrial inner tube and you go down a mountain river and, you know, there's drops and splashes. It's fun. I don't know what, what the part of it is that I'm missing. There's no Uncle Remus jumping out and tipping his hat. There's nothing like that. So,
well, you know,
I just don't think they went any reference to the movie.
Yeah, they just know that the movie has, I guess, some racist stereotypes, right? So they're taking it out. You know, I love, by the way, how corporations have co-opted the BLM thing. Like Chase Manhattan is like, "Hi, we at Chase understand that you're black. We are here to help." You know, meanwhile, it's just unbelievable how corporations immediately
will be much nicer to you when we deny. Yeah, we'll be much nicer to you when you deny your small business loan.
Yes, yes.
Somebody said yesterday there's that Jersey Mike's subs has a BLT and they're changing it to bacon, lettuce, and mater. So it's BLM?
Mater?
Yeah, like short for tomato.
That's hilarious.
And I think it was Ben Schwartz who said McDonald's better come out with a Bernie Mac really soon.
Oh my God.
But it's you know, Lenin the Russian revolutionary Vladimir Ilyich Yanov.
I loved early Lenin.
When he was in the silver.
He sold out. Yeah, I thought he sold out eventually, but
also
Lenin was always good.
Lenin, like John Lennon, very much into Asian chicks. But he had a quote that says, "Sometimes decades go by and nothing happens, and sometimes weeks go by and decades happen." And that's
going on, man.
It's really true. And I wonder, like, are we in the midpoint of this? Are we at the beginning of it?
I think I think me and you are similar, that the more information we know, the worse off we are. And 100%. I am constantly digging deeper than the headlines, you know, like the other day, and this is not to brag, I was listening to an epidemiologist say, you know, and this woman, Laurie Garrett is her name, and she wrote a book called The Coming Plague before the COVID thing.
Oh, okay.
And she says, and I mean, she's a pretty good authority. She says, we've got, because of the way it's going, you know, that it's just, you know, cases now are spreading. She says, we've got 36 months of this. 36 months. Now, when I hear that, I
36 months
go,
before herd immunity or?
Of dealing with this. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know what she meant specifically, but she basically was saying, if you think, you know, we're going to get a vaccine and this is all going to be over by early 2021, think again. And
right. I think she's right. It sounds like she's right. I know that they're not, mm-hmm. you know, and all right, let's go to the real plague in this country is the mm-hmm. stupidity.
Oh my God.
And just this knee jerk. And it really is to the point mm-hmm. where people that are aggressively disseminating blatantly false information. It would be great if we had a government that actually would step in and go, you can't do this. But they're actually doing what the government wants them to do because the government is run by incompetence.
Well, it really, I mean, if we're not a banana republic with a great military, what are we? You know what I mean?
Oh, no, like, we are an exceptionally powerful third world country.
We really are, you know, and it is staggering. Do you remember when people were like, well, I'm going to vote for Trump just to shake things up.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to shake things up. Well, wow.
Yeah. Here's another way to shake.
Yeah. Nightmare.
Yeah. No, it's
come to pass.
Historically, it's perfect because it does. It was absolutely like, let's let the chimp drive the bus. Let's see what happens. You know, it's like, you want to shake things up. Give a monkey an M16 and turn him loose in a flea market. And it is like, it does make you think in some sort of weird divine justice. Cause it is like the world said, oh yeah. Okay. Here's this, you know, and it was just like
oh,
a plague.
Exactly.
And what is amazing, and just to finish the thought, what is amazing is his feral dedication to not doing anything outside of his own personal self-interest.
Yeah.
Even by mistake, even it doesn't take, it proves that his narcissism has escalated to the point of mental illness.
Oh.
Because even the average narcissist would be able to extrapolate that by appearing selfless, it will help me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the one silver lining of massive death that we're facing is that I think this fucking imbecile will be gone.
I do as well. And this is what it took. Like, you know, people forget, like, what did it take for a black guy named Barack Hussein Obama to get elected? The economy had to fall. The sun had to fall out of the sky and crash into the ocean. You know, my brother, Mike, who's no liberal, voted for Obama because he was so pissed off at what George Bush did to his 401k, you know?
Oh, wow.
You know, and now he has a Donald Trump doll in his house. Like, you know, but that's what it took. And what I don't understand is all of these places like Texas, Arizona, and Florida that ignored, take out government, put in dad. You know, it's like, you know, the smart people are saying wear a mask, then I'm not gonna.
Yeah.
And now that's like, okay, well, now how you like it? How do you like it now? When is the headline on CNN going to be, told you so? Well, you know, they do such a good job of working the refs. You know,
I think pretty soon we're just going to have, hi, I'm Wolf Blitzer, and we're in the Situation Room, and Wolf is just going to cry to the cameras. And that's going to be the news, like Blitzer just weeping and like he doesn't even get a word out. And then he lifts his head and he goes, commercial break. And then we come back and he's weeping and the camera's shaking because the cameraman's weeping. I mean, that's what we're headed for. Matter of fact, I heard a guy who, you know, is kind of like my barometer of what things are going on, what is going on. And this guy, Chris Hedges, his name is, and he said,
yeah, you told me about Chris Hedges. Yeah.
Oh, Chris Hedges is amazing. He goes, we're going to look back at this as the good old days. And what he meant is that, and I don't know what you think, but if this continues on, right, what the economy, it's so many things are going under. What is going to happen? There's going to be massive unemployment.
Well, I think a couple of things. Mm-hmm. In my take, I think that we're going to find, you know, we're going to see what eventually we're going to see the real books on the accounting of this country. And we're going to find out how much money they really are sitting on when they're like, we better cut Social Security for this. But I also think I do believe in the innate adaptability of humanity, that we will adapt to, you know, the economy 2.0, where it will be, you know, and there will be all of the things that you're describing, but we will develop this germ, you know, this germ aware economy, things like this, you know, and Zoom shows and ways to, but no, it's going to be, I also believe you might get things like guaranteed yearly income. The government is going to have to keep shoveling money at people and absolutely, grudgingly admitting that it has the money.
Well, I don't know what your understanding is of this first stimulus that went through, but they gave trillions again. Trillions, yeah, which is a number, by the way, that I have trouble. You know, I can count up to like 190. But a trillion.
Trillions only comes in with my calorie count.
Yes. But they gave trillions to people who already have mucho money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the thieves always get first. The thieves always get right in there first.
Well, and you know, the stats about the inequality of wealth now are just staggering. I mean, Bezos may be the first trillionaire. Have you heard that?
No.
He has made, you haven't heard that? Bezos has made, I don't know how many billions since this started, but, you know, people, I think I've been heartened by the protest. I kind of went near one because it's down my, it was right down my block. And
yeah,
the people who were protesting, young kids, I think they see through this scam,
mm-hmm,
that's going on, and they're savvy and they're organizing. And that to me is also another silver lining. But yes, things are going to change massively. They have to, like you're saying, adaptability. Yes, it's going, it has to.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, my opinion, based on just, you know, like I equate 2020 to 1968. Where just everything hit the shit hit the fan all at once. Mm-hmm. And like 68 to 72, 73, we're going to have a 4 or 5 year period where these fundamental blocks of society are shoved forward. People are forced to grow, and awareness is, you know, in the way that in the late 60s, early 70s, women's rights and the anti-war movement and all those things sort of pushed society out of that mid-century Cold War mentality. And then I think it will recede. You know, you go forward 4 steps, you go back 2 steps, and then you go forward 4 more steps. I don't see things going back to the way they were. And I'm very interested to see what's going to happen if Trump does lose, knock wood, No, I'm so alarmed. I'm afraid to say it.
Well, as long as Biden takes his Adderall or whatever the hell he needs to take to stay
he's semi-present. So far, he's good so far. I think
that they've been hiding him away a lot,
and it's and it's working, and it's working.
right.
Yeah. I do believe that somebody's going to come forward and go, guys, I don't think you understand how much they fuck shit up. You know, it's like when you move into a house, like, a house looks good. Actually, no, the foundation beams are rotten. We need to pull the house apart. We need to, you know, the systemic damage that has been done is so beyond the pale. I still don't understand it. And I know a lot of Republicans.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But they all hate him. I mean, every Republican that I talk to is a never Trumper Republican. I don't understand the people that just, because the people that love him aren't Republicans. Like, they don't believe in conservatism in the literal sense. They're on team sports, and it's the sort of the Joe Rogan chest thumping, I'm a tough guy. He shook things up. I mean, they don't know the difference between, you know, they call themselves conservatives, but they hate George Will. Well, then you're not a conservative if you don't, you know, it's like he's not a conservative. He spends money hand over fist. But it's just the people that are in that cult of personality for him is mind-boggling, and they just say it's like non-college educated blank blank blank. And I'm not saying that people that didn't go to college are dumb, but they are people that don't have a, let's say, tradition of critical thinking.
Hey, look, I've met a lot of morons in college, you know.
I went to UMass.
Well, I went to, brace yourself, the College of Staten Island. There is actually a thing called the College of Staten Island. And basically you go in there with the baseball bat and you just kind of fight your way through that school. But
the school is like that scene in Escape from New York where Kurt Russell has the baseball.
Yeah, the graduation ceremony is just a chokehold.
you're given a trash can lid and a bat with a nail in it.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. But, things are going to change. People really don't get off their asses until they're directly affected.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
and that's always been the case, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, people forget, like, you know, nothing that Hitler was doing bothered anybody in this country.
Right.
The Japanese bombed us, and we declared war on Japan, not Germany.
Yeah.
We were still fine.
Oh, is that right?
We were still fine with Germany. The next day, Germany declared war on us, and we were forced to go to war with it. Yeah. We didn't have a problem with anything. No, people don't care about the fire until it gets on their lawn.
And by the way, you know, Trump is like the poster child for narcissism. But you know what? We have a nation full of narcissists. People who I mean, look, you talked about at the beginning, you know, the stupidity being the plague. And the reason why that is that people, well, first of all, educationally, we're horrific, but we are a nation of narcissists, and now we're forced not to be.
Yeah. And it's, I agree. And it'll be interesting to see if it takes, because that narcissism is cooked into the American self-image of, like, you know, never mind that he was a draft dodger wearing makeup, you know, the John Wayne out on his horse is how Americans, this rugged individualism is the sort of the Scotch-Irish DNA strain that people use as to identify themselves as American. But that doesn't mean that a community effort is a bad thing. It's like, you know, people don't like the government right. telling them to wear a mask, but they stop at a stoplight. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just there's a thing called yeah. public safety.
Yeah. By the way, I am a little pissed at the enforcement on masks seems to not be happening. Like I,
no.
when I walk out on the
I
street.
I think that will change. I think that will change yeah. if, well, it's not, and it's getting, I've noticed it. Do you go out a lot? Let's cut right to the chase.
Well, I don't want to brag that I have access to the outdoors. you know,
that was when you were single. That was your Tinder profile lead-in. I have access to the outdoors. I wanted to put like a Tinder profile and just like, let's get this out of the way. I swing with the Bible.
No, I don't. I don't because I'm really scared about it, you know, about the COVID because, you know, I am overweight again, not to brag, but I, you know, have access to food.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I just don't think.
Do you go to the, but you go to the store, right?
Yes. We go to the store occasionally. We kind of get a lot of stuff delivered,
uh-huh.
you know, and I just like it gets delivered. I douse it in Clorox, set it on fire, and then we have to order it again. But, which, you know, it's expensive, but safe. but yeah. But when I do go out, and you know what? Because of the spike now, because of the incredible spike now, I don't want to go out. I was thinking of going to some doctors, you know, because I have incredible growths.
Really?
Happening.
Let me take a look at those. I've been going out. I got one of this mask that makes me look like Bane.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's a good one, yeah. though. That looks good.
Yeah, this is a...
It looks
good. It's already falling apart. This is a Taiwanese pollution mask. It's got a thing in the inside,
yes.
too. Yes. And so...
Oh, you get... You know, my sister married a Taiwanese citizen, so they get, I think, 30 masks per citizen.
Yeah.
And so my sister has mailed me some N95 equivalent.
Yeah.
Mass. And that's when I feel free as a bird. Like I'll put one of those babies on.
Yeah.
And I interact with folks, you
well,
know?
I have three kids, so I go to the store every day, pretty much.
You do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm out doing something every day. I wear a mask. I wash. I have Purell in the car and I Purell when I get back in the car and you
wear gloves?
No, I don't wear gloves anymore. Well, they found it doesn't transmit that way as much as we thought.
Through surfaces?
Yeah, you don't have to wipe down your groceries. You don't have to. That was on the CDC website. And one thing I have cut back on, I have not cut it out. I have cut back on when in a store, I used to would go up to people and try to get them to put their fingers in my mouth. I don't do that as much.
You were doing the Aziz and sorry thing.
I'm Joe Biden and I want to put your fingers in my mouth. That's how he should. But,
oh my God.
But no, I go out and, you know, we were, you know, you, but I'd rather, like, I feel weird. Like I wanted to have, like some people on 4th of July, like, can you have somebody over your house if they wear a mask and they're 6 feet apart in the backyard? And then is that fun?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't feel, you know, and apparently what caused the spike was all of those parties and bar, like people going out to bars and restaurants.
Yeah, but they wouldn't wear a mask. I mean,
no, that's what I mean. They weren't wearing masks and they just went, pretended it wasn't over. And it's like, okay, fucker, enjoy your prefrontal lobe permanent damage.
Right, exactly. Oh, that's another thing this epidemiologist was talking about is how this virus...
It's much worse than you think.
It affects neurological. It affects vascular. You
yeah,
know?
It's much...
I have a friend...
The lasting damage is...
Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, I mean, I barely get along in life with everything working. So I can't imagine having something like that. You know what I mean? And I have a friend who is 29 who got this thing early, about the end of March. And he still, to this day, he's 29, fit, you know, thin kid, fit, and he still has lung issues, gets tired very quickly. He still is hurting, you know, and this is 3 months later, 29 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it seems like it's roulette how it affects people.
Yeah. I do know that a lot of people who attended the rally in Tulsa are now coming down with. I know Herman Cain,
the pizza guy?
Yeah, that ran for president. He went to Trump's rally in Tulsa, and is hospitalized with COVID now. I think a lot of people got it at that rally.
Yeah, that rally was such a.
And Joe Rogan is doing a tour now where he and his
is he?
Yeah, he's on tour now. He's playing that place in Tulsa that Trump was. And every day he goes on his podcast and talks about how masks are for bitches. And it's just like,
no,
I'm just like, to me, it's just social Darwinism. It's like, okay, go.
He really said, and he's got, you know, what's funny is that I've been promoting my special. So
sure.
I want to get on.
Of course
I
want
to get on his podcast.
Of course you do.
Because there's millions,
of course,
but I wouldn't be able to deal with.
Well, it's like I'm friends with
that. Joe said that to me.
Yeah. Oh, you.
And he's a nice dude.
That's the thing. I don't know Joe at all. I don't know Joe at all. I know Adam Carolla.
Yeah, I know him from the
comedy
school.
Carolla really well. And
you do.
Yeah, and I like Adam. We don't talk about politics.
What is? Don't tell me he's a non-master.
Oh yeah, no. I don't listen regularly, but he wasn't for a long time.
Well, I just
and that's fine. But like,
understand that.
I don't consider myself evil. Because I like Adam Carolla as a guy. You know,
like, no, you're evil for other
100%.
Reasons. You know, you're evil because of your personal life. But Carolla,
and boy, when they excavate my backyard, boy.
Hey, Bob, there's too many bones.
It's going to look like behind the titty twister at the end of From Dusk Till Dawn. That's the seventh titty twister reference I've made today.
Well, it flows off the tongue, and it really does. But for these guys to be doing this during a life and death thing, and
it's public hazard.
Not only that, again, it comes down to I wear the mask to protect you. Not
right.
Me. And that is so foreign to a great deal of Americans.
Yeah, well, it's
very foreign.
It's again, it runs counter to and it runs counter to what they think being an American is about, which is selflessness is un-American. You know, it's like that. It's true. It's like that whole Gordon, like when you know, the whole 80s mantra of, you know, greed is good. It cuts through the...
Yeah.
That was from Wall Street. That was Michael Douglas in Wall Street. That was his character. Based on Donald Trump. You know, but it's like...
Was it even back then? Huh?
And it's like, as was Christopher Walken's character in A View to a Kill. They're all based on Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But it's like, he was the villain in that movie. You know, it's like people like the villain comes out and people love the villain. It's like, no. He was the bad guy. He went to prison, remember?
By the way, I just want to get this out about Republicans and Trump. I just like to get this out because I just want to say the Democrats, a lot of the Democrats, if not, and I think most of them are culpable in this too, because they sold out. They sold out working people. They really did. And there's such anger. I mean,
I don't argue with that. I don't argue that point at all. I completely agree with you on that point.
I just want to get out that Trump is a symptom of the
100%
of the fucking rot in this country. And you know, that greed, you know, the polarization of wealth, which I forget. Of course, I never remember any goddamn facts, but the polarization of wealth now is equal to, like, I forget if it's the Habsburg dynasty or the some ridiculous polarization, you know, that five families own fucking like half of the GNP. You know, you got to take care of people, and that's what you have to do. You have to take care of people. And one other thing I want to say is that I've noticed, though, like when a catastrophe hits a community, flooding from a hurricane or whatever, people do pull together. I mean, I've seen that, right? You've seen that people really do pull together.
Yeah, absolutely. So, when the shit hits the fan, when it becomes real,
yeah,
I think that's mm-hmm. just the human nature. You know, and there are always, here's the other thing. Mm-hmm. 20 people, in any group of 25 mm-hmm. people, there's going to be two mm-hmm. pricks. And the news cameras will always.
Hey, leave my father out of it.
The news camera will always point to those pricks and tell that story.
Oh, yeah.
And then everybody thinks, well, everybody's true. A prick. You know, I have four brothers, a sister, my dad. They're all Trump Republicans.
No. Yeah,
100%. They live in the middle of Massachusetts. They live in, it's basically upstate New York. You know, it's camouflage, right. Camo hoodies and gun racks and hunting God. And NRA.
Oh,
but they all wear masks. They all wear masks. And my brother Kevin is a home inspector. And he said he went into a house to inspect it, and the people in the house had friends over because they're buying a house, and none of them were wearing masks. And he said, like, you guys leave or I leave. You know, it's like, because not good. Yeah. So there's
good.
Not everybody is a lunatic, but they only tell the lunatics' stories. But I do think.
Yes, I agree.
But if we had a president who was an adult, they would have gotten every living president together for like, and go like, you know, I'm Jimmy Carter, I'm George Bush, I'm Barack Obama. You need to wear a mask. This is not a partisan issue. This is not, you know, and that was, you know, people shit on George W. Bush for many, 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 many very good reasons. And the argument the argument that he should be in prison is a decent argument. But he did, after 9/11, go to a mosque and say, this is not about all Muslims. And he didn't have to do that. I don't know what good it did, but I give him credit for trying in that regard.
Right. Well, you know, Trump has set the bar so low.
Oh, literally.
Now.
If we get a president who, like, Joe Biden just has to go like, I'm Joe Biden and I wipe. Like, all right. He wipes. Let's have him.
Yeah, exactly. But why, like,
and I know that you were, I know that you were Biden from the get-go. I know that you were.
Yeah.
I know that you're captain centrist to your friends.
But why did your family get the mask message if they're Trumpites? Is it your influence?
No. I think that they're just
they have a brain.
Yeah, they're smart. You know, their mm-hmm. cultural identity is Republican. With mm-hmm. you know, tough guys, NRA, gun rights, tough guys. Mm-hmm. So they culturally identify with Republicans. I think they would quietly admit that he's an idiot. I know that they thought he was an idiot when he was running. I know that they all thought he was a fucking idiot when he was running, but then he won and they're like, no, he's our guy.
And
you know, it's Red Sox Yankees to them. And, they wear masks and they're very,
by the way, I saw someone with the Red Sox. I'm from New York and. So I'm a big Yankee fan, and I saw someone with the Red Sox t-shirt the other day, and I was like, oh my God, I remember a time when that actually had some meaning to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it was, you know, it was a simpler time. It's so insane now. And there, and by the way, sports has been completely shelved and they're trying to restart, three professional leagues. And it's kind of sad, you know, the average sports fan who like lived for sports is like, oh, they're going to start up again and give me a reason to live. But, you know, then somebody tests positive and the whole thing has to shut down. It's just, I don't see
people,
it.
It's, you know, no
I don't
one
see it happening.
You know, somebody, it's too bad that somebody can't get on the television and go, this is the plague and you're going to die if you don't stop fucking around. And we've never had this,
unreal.
You know, but people aren't going to do that because nobody wants to. Self-interest. Let's say we get lucky and he loses.
Which seems like it's going to happen.
It's early, and I don't underestimate the idiocy of this culture. But yeah, what will be interesting to see if it really, if he's down by 2025 going into it, if he resigns first and lets Pence
lose. Right.
Which I don't.
That's the thing that's going around that he may just drop out.
I don't know. He's a deeply mentally disturbed person. So it is like, you know, you let a feral pit bull into your house. And like, I don't know what he's going to do. He might kill us. He might take a nap. Right. I can't tell. But it will be interesting to see how quickly the Lindsey Grahams and the Kellyanne Conways slither in front of a camera. Well, we always knew he sucked and we were just trying to control it.
Yeah.
And, you know, those snakes should not be allowed to get away with that.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Absolutely. I'm hoping that he goes to jail and a few others, to say the least. That would be nice. Or at least beheaded on pay-per-view, something equivalent to what he has.
I'm not averse to that.
No, pay-per-view. It could raise a lot.
I would like him, and I'll probably get grief for this, but I would like him beaten to death with Don Jr. I would like Don Jr. frozen so that he's hard, and then Trump is beaten to death with Don Jr. Before we go, what is your day like now? It's
well, I do a podcast. Well, you were on the bunker.
I was on the bunker earlier.
The bunker. I'd love to have you back.
Anytime.
But I do that Monday through Friday. Every day at 4. So that roots.
Sure.
Me,
gives you something.
Know?
To, gives you
like,
reason to get out of bed.
Me, well, I wouldn't go that far, but it does. It does like kind of root my day. And then I also, and again, this isn't to brag. I like to do some squats in the park,
uh-huh.
like exercise in that podcast. And, you know, the special just came out. So I'm doing all these interviews. I have this illusion now that I have a life. Again.
Yeah, sure. Natch. Yeah. Well,
you know, my dogs, I don't have children, but my dogs need to be walked. Twice a day.
Yeah, I got,
and I need to be there.
I got,
you know,
well, thank God. I've done a lot of stuff in the house. I've turned my garage into like a workspace. I blew out my rotator cuff moving shit in my garage. And, I haven't done anything, that I should have been doing, like writing a movie, but I've,
oh, yeah.
But I did go on eBay and buy back a lot of my childhood toys.
But, you know, speaking of simpler times, Ghost and Mr. Chicken was on again the other night. Now, I'm thinking, imagine Don Knotts during the pandemic. Like, we're a bunch of weren't you the one who had a Don Knotts mask?
Yes, I do. I do. Yeah. From Jeff.
Where did you get that, by the way?
Go on Instagram. Jeff Braun, B-R-A-W-N. He does a bunch of great, great masks. I got a Don Knotts one. I got a Tor Johnson one. He has Evil Knievel.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
He has. He's. It's. I mean,
Jeff Braun on.
I'll text it to you when I'm done. I just bought remember John Candy as Dr. Tongue on SCTV? I have
John Candy.
Yeah, I got Dr. Tongue's 3D House of Stewardesses t-shirt. I'll text you the link when we're done.
Love this. Karen's going to love that stuff. And also Comfort TV. Like then the other thing that, trying to come. I'm doing things I never thought I'd be doing, like taking sound baths. I don't even know if you know what that
I do.
Means,
I do. My girlfriend's like, a hippie. I know all about
that. Yeah. Well, I'm like listening to sound baths on my headphones, and it's like Buddhist monks with singing.
Yeah, sure.
And that's how bad it's gotten. It's gotten that bad that I'm listening to bowls that sing. I used to just eat out of bowls.
Now they sing.
Bowls are singing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And Comfort TV, by the way, Columbo is very important.
Perry Mason.
To me.
Although I can't watch Adam 12 anymore because it's like, because Martin Milner really is a prick. Like Martin
is
Milner,
he?
If you watch Adam 12.
I used to love
he's
that as
such
a kid.
It's on MeTV, but watch it. He's such a cock. Like he would absolutely be a cop that beats the fuck out of somebody.
Yeah. And I love these genteel British things like Poirot.
Oh, sure.
Like there's nothing like a civilized murder. In
I agree 100%.
You know,
have you ever seen the Lars von Trier film Melancholia?
Oh, I think I tell me again.
It's a group of people. Charlotte Gainsbourg, Kirsten Dunst, Kiefer Sutherland. They're in a big country house in somewhere. And there's another planet that has broken loose from its solar system and is on a collision course towards Earth. And they know they're all going to die.
Oh, I got to. Yeah. That's very prescient.
Well,
right
yeah,
now,
Kat
huh?
wanted to watch it because she's Scandinavian and she wanted me to understand.
What's up with
well,
those
she watched it so I would understand the Scandinavian sense of doom. And
there's another.
Yeah. And, at the end of the movie, normally we'll watch a movie at night and then we'll go to bed. And at the end of Melancholia, which has the same ending as Beneath the Planet of the Apes, not to ruin it. I was so I made her watch Goldfinger as like a palate cleanser. And she'd never seen it before. And she was like, I'm pussy galore. And she's like, get the fuck out of here.
That's so funny. There's another Lars von Trier movie, and I forget the name of it, but they're all gathered for a wedding. Okay, they're all gathered for a wedding, and there's the rehearsal dinner, I guess, and they're all giving toasts. And somebody gets up and starts talking about how they were molested by their father. And it turns out the father has molested a bunch of his family. And they all start sharing. And the whole thing just escalates into this incredible horror. And I like to order out when I watch that.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is amazing. That is amazing. We'll check in with you soon. Let me know when I can come back to the bunker, and
absolutely.
Stay safe.
And my special is For the Masses.
That's right, For the Masses. I opened for you on
my
that special. By the way.
Oh, I forgot.
That was back
right.
in the days of life,
dude. It's getting great.
It's
reviews.
A brilliant special. You should be proud of it.
Thank you. I
and where what's it street? Is it on Amazon Prime or is it on Netflix?
Yes, it is. It's on Amazon Prime. No, Netflix wanted nothing.
No, me neither.
To
me neither.
Me. I did not fit their algorithm. I did not fit their demo,
no. I know
whatever it is.
We have. I don't want to mention his name because he might not want this story out. But a friend of ours, has a special, and they were having a casual conversation about with somebody from Netflix. You know, just like a social interaction.
Right.
And they were like, yeah, like if you had had cancer and came back, like, and we had an angle and he was like, then we would,
is
yeah, then
right?
we would be. And he's like, so I have to have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
is.
Oh my God! Is it our allergy?
That's what I would hope. Yeah. What about a What about a rotator cuff injury? What if I'm just sore?
So, yeah, I broke my ankle recently.
I'm disappointed, but a lot.
It's on Amazon Prime. It's on a lot of.
And it's called For the. It's called For the Masses. It's really great.
It's called For the, thank you so much. But,
and it's a fun, nostalgic look at live performing.
Well, you know what's so funny is everybody is like, oh, Pepitone, this is your time. You know, we're in a tremendous, you know, state of decay and decline. And, buddy, that's you.
I know. It's true.
Oh, my God, this is an Eddie Pepitone bit come to life. And, you know, I feel two ways about
it. I understand. Well, Eddie, in addition to being one of my favorite people and favorite comedians, you and I are in the half dozen comedians that have never dated underaged girls. So we really need to stick together.
Men, there's a drive-in movie full of juicy people. Wow! It's a trap! Help! It's Pick! We've had it, men.
A pleasant aroma for you, but not for mosquitoes. Pick is easy to use. Light it and forget it. Pick's aroma keeps mosquitoes, gnats, and sandflies away. Pick is the best protection for barbecues, fishing and camping trips, or just relaxing in the yard.
So if you don't want our company ever anywhere, just like Pick and see what I mean? Bye!
Pick is on sale at the refreshment stand now.
They're true tales from Weirdsville. Tales from Weirdsville. And they're true.
Can your heart stand the shocking
facts? When I think of the summer, I think of the drive-in. If you listen to this podcast, you know that I love the drive-in. I worked at the drive-in in high school. The drive-in that I worked at is still going, the Mendon Twin in Mendon, Massachusetts. As I record this, I'm going to the drive-in tonight. There's a great drive-in in Southern California we go to called Mission Tiki, going to see the Relic. And I'm going to tell you a story about two men that made a lot of movies that you could probably only see at a drive-in or at a grindhouse in the late 1960s and early 1970s. It is a fascinating story. But first, we need to meet a guy named Victor Adamson. Victor Adamson was a cowboy. He was a real cowboy. He was born in 1890 in New Zealand, and he did rope tricks. He made his way to the United States. He changed his name to Denver Dixon, and he began acting in silent cowboy movies. He's an old man now. It's the early 60s, but he raises a little money, and he starts shooting his own Western called Highway to Hell. I'm sorry, Halfway to Hell. Highway to Hell was too good of a title. He's shooting a Western called Halfway to Hell. Now, Denver's an old man by this time, but whatever. Well, the actor that he hired to play the villain, he had a problem, and he walked off the movie. And then Denver got disgusted, and he walked off the movie. The problem was, it was his own movie. He walked off his own movie. Anyway, Denver's son, Al Adamson, remember, Denver's real name was Victor Adamson. He was acting in the movie, playing a small part as a favor to his dad. And when his dad quit the movie, Al stepped up, directed, and finished the film. So once Halfway to Hell was finished, Denver said, well, take it to New York and meet my friend Sam Sherman, and maybe he can help you sell it. Now, Sam Sherman is a monster kid from New York City, and he loves all the stuff that you love. He loves monster movies. He loves Western movies. He's a monster nerd. He's a movie nerd. Now, Al and Sam were about the same age, and they got on really well. And even though Halfway to Hell didn't do anything, they became friends. Now we're in the mid-60s, about 64, 65, and Al is running a nightclub in the San Fernando Valley. and he's managing a singer named Tacy Robbins. Not Tracy, Tacy. And Al thinks big, and he thinks the way to raise Tacy's profile would be if she starred in a movie. So he raises a little money, gets a hold of a script, and sets about directing Echo of Terror, starring an unknown nightclub singer named Tacy Robbins, who, in a giant stretch, plays an unknown nightclub singer fleeing a mad killer. Echo of Terror is finished, and Al takes it to New York to show Sam Sherman in the hopes that they can sell it. They can't sell it, but the distributors do like it. And one of them says, there's just nothing special about it. It's a crime movie, it's okay, it doesn't star anybody, there's no hook. You know what's a good hook? Go-go dancing. Go-go dancing is a huge craze. Try to get go-go dancing in the title. So Al goes back and inserts scenes of go-go dancing. And Echo of Terror becomes Psycho a Go-Go.
Now, a motion picture of pulse-pounding excitement, of desire inflamed to madness and murder by the wild, provocative young bodies of the Go-Go Girls.
Psycho a Go-Go did not play. So Al and Sam went back again, this time to try and make it a horror movie. They got a star, John Carradine, who played Dracula in all the Universal movies after Bela Lugosi was retired by Universal. He played him in House of Dracula, House of Frankenstein. He's also the father of David Carradine, who was Bill in Kill Bill and was the star of Kung Fu. You know David Carradine. I also got Tommy Kirk, who was one of Ed Wood's old cronies. He's in Village of the Giants. So now they shoot some new scenes showing John Carradine putting the evil brain into the head of the psycho killer from the movie. They also shot a zombie bank robber scene. And Psycho a Go-Go, formerly Echo of Terror, now became Blood of Ghastly Horror.
Oh, human zombies rise from their coffins as living corpses in Blood of Ghastly Horror.
And Blood of Ghastly Horror didn't make a lick of sense and nobody cared. So then Al tried to make another cop movie. This was called The Fakers, about a gang of no-goodniks who were printing up counterfeit money to finance a Nazi revolution. The Fakers had a name actor, Broderick Crawford, who was the star of Highway Patrol. The Fakers was shot and finished, and nobody cared. But in 1969, Easy Rider came out and turned the movie industry inside out. In addition to throwing the major studios into turmoil and panic, it made motorcycle movies all the rage. So, Sam and Al shot some new footage about a Nazi biker gang, and the Fakers became Hell's Bloody Devils, and no one cared.
You can't afford to miss Hell's Bloody Devils.
Al then became involved in a Western to be shot in Italy, a low-budget version of the moderate-budget movies Clint Eastwood was making at that time. The movie fell apart after Al Adamson had sunk every dime he had into it, about $50,000 in 1969 dollars. Al returned from Italy literally penniless. He needed work, he needed a movie, he needed something to shoot, and he needed it now. He met an investor who wanted a biker movie to cash in on the Easy Rider craze. But he did not want that movie to be Hell's Bloody Devils. So Al stayed up all night and wrote the story for Satan's Sadists. That's how you know the story is good. He did it in a night. Satan's Sadists tells the story of a motorcycle gang chasing a young couple through the desert through what is literally the weekend from hell. The investor gave it a thumbs up, and Al returned to LA with a job. But he needed a star. Enter Russ Tamblyn of West Side Story, Tom Thumb, and a scrappy little Toho classic called War of the Gargantuas. And much later, Dr. Jacoby on Twin Peaks, as well as being the father of actress Amber Tamblyn, and therefore also David Cross's father-in-law. Sidebar, fun fact, I know from personal experience that Russ Tamblyn is a great guy, so you know. But this was 1969, and Russ Tamblyn had pretty much dropped out of show business and was concentrating on painting and art, which is great, but it doesn't pay as much as being a movie star. Russ agreed to do Satan's Sadists, provided he be given free rein with acting and dialogue. Al agreed. And if you've ever seen Satan's Sadist, you can rest assured that if there is any dialogue in there that you like, it's probably Russ Tamblyn's. Satan's Sadist was shot in Indio, California, just outside of Palm Springs, and what was for Al Adamson a luxurious two-week schedule. For the biker mama, Al cast the waitress from the coffee shop down the street from his office, a blonde, former Vegas showgirl named Regina Carroll. Nature took its course, and after meeting, Al and Regina would never leave each other's side. From that day forward, in sickness and health.
The shocking scenes you're about to see are not suggested for the weak or immature. If you cannot take it, we advise you to now patronize the concession stand or look away from the screen during this preview of Satan's Sadists.
Satan's Sadists is actually pretty enjoyable in a low-budget, crazy way, and it made, on its investment, a fortune. And suddenly people cared. I mean, not everybody. Major studios did not come knocking. But in the worlds that Al and Sam Sherman worked in, the drive-in movie theater circuit, the grindhouse cinema circuit, people absolutely did care, and Al and Sam's company suddenly had cred. And all of those films that they had made, which had just been sitting on the shelves gathering dust, suddenly got scooped up. Films like Five Bloody Graves, Horror of the Blood Monsters, Blood of Ghastly Horror, and Hell's Bloody Devils all suddenly were unspooling on drive-in screens throughout the country. One of the new films they embarked upon was called The Female Bunch, sort of the Wild Bunch with boobs. It was about an all-girl outlaw gang that lived out in the desert on a ranch. Russ Tamblyn was back, as well as the Wolfman himself, Lon Chaney Jr., croaking what few lines he had as he struggled through the final stages of the throat cancer that would soon take his life. The film was shot in L.A. in the summer of 1969. Parts of the film were shot on the old Spann movie ranch while the Manson family was still living there. At one point during the production of the film, Charles Manson was hanging around the set and leering at the actresses, to the point that Adamson had one of the stuntmen escort him off the set. And it was only a few weeks after the movie left the ranch that Charlie and the family were arrested. Then Al made Dracula vs. Frankenstein. He cast his stockbroker, Roger Engel, to play Dracula. They changed his name for the film to Sandor Vorkoff. Not Count Dracula's, Roger Engel's. Fori Ackerman is in that movie too, and it is something to see. Dracula looks like Frank Zappa, and Frankenstein looks like a burnt marshmallow. It is a stinker. Believe you me. 1973 saw The Naughty Stewardesses, a booby sex comedy that gave way to a sequel, Blazing Stewardesses, which tried to cash in on Blazing Saddle's success and men's love of seeing tits on screen. Now, a couple years later, during the CB trucker craze, Blazing Stewardesses was re-released as The Great Truck Robbery. And a couple years after that, when The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas came out, it was re-released again as Cat House Cowgirls. Now, it's very possible that you had paid money to see Blazing Stewardesses and then paid money to see The Great Truck Robbery and not realize until it was too late that it was just the same movie with a different title. Some other Al Adamson and Sam Sherman movies that are definitely worth seeing, Black Heat, Black Samurai, in which Jim Kelly in one scene fights two little people and a vulture. And for my money, the weirdest film he ever made, Cinderella 2000. Just, holy shit. The drive-in circuit and the grindhouse circuit began to die out in the late 70s and early 1980s. It was the early days of cable, home video was starting, and major studios were making their own B-movies now, with A-budgets. Not long after his career went into hibernation, Regina Carroll Al's wife and constant companion, died of cancer. And Al, sadly, withdrew into himself. He left the business and moved to a house in Indio, California, where he concentrated on his other businesses and his investments. He wasn't rich, but he had done okay. He also developed an obsession with UFOs, which happens when you live in the desert. Al hired a couple, the Garcias, to work for him, and they lived out of a trailer, and Adamson paid them to work as a housekeeper and a landscaper, and he let them park the trailer on his property to make use of the resources and the facilities. It was a good deal all around, and the three grew very close. Enter Fred Fulford. Fred Fulford was a contractor hired by Al Adamson to do some work around the house. And as always happens, mission creep sets in. One job turns into six. Al gave Fred a credit card to use to buy supplies, but Fred immediately overspent and was using it to buy all sorts of shit. He started dressing like Al and wearing his hair like Al. Things were getting tense and weird, and this was not a movie, it was real life. So Al calls his brother, and he says, I'm going to get rid of this guy. And his brother says, okay, but let me get there. He sounds a little crazy. Al's brother lived about 2 hours away, and he heads to the ranch. But by the time he gets there, Fred Fulford is there, and he went, oh, yeah, Al's not here. He went to look at a car. This was not completely unlike Al. So his brother split, went back to his house, called later on that day, said he's still not here. Checked in a day later, and Fred says, oh no, Al took off. He went to look at one of his properties in Texas. Now again, this is unusual, but not unheard of. It's also the mid-90s, so we don't have cell phones yet. Still, Al's brother is suspicious. Then Fred threw the weird switch. He moved into Al's house, changed all the locks, evicted the Garcias, without any authority to do so. Al's brother filed a missing persons report, and the police finally got involved. In a very touching scene from the documentary Blood and Flesh, the documentary about Al Adamson, in which most of this information came, and the details about which I will soon fill you in on, Sam Sherman, being interviewed in New York, says, I didn't know where Al was, and I couldn't get a hold of him. So I just sat down and I said, I'm going to concentrate really hard. And wherever Al is, I'm going to try to reach him. And one word came into my mind. Cement. Yep. Al's brother, the police, and the Garcias searched Al's house. By now, Fred had disappeared. The first thing Mrs. Garcia noticed was that Fred had changed all of Al's bedding and removed all the photos of Al and his family and friends that hung around the house. Then Al's brother noticed that the hot tub was missing. Al had an indoor hot tub that was his pride and joy, and for some reason, Fred had demolished it, hauled it out, and replaced the flooring with new tile. Yeah, you know where this is going. And you're right. Al Adamson did not wait for his brother to arrive to confront Fred Fulford. When he did confront him, Fred Fulford killed Al with a hammer, tore out his hot tub, dug a hole, wrapped him in his own bedding, dumped him in the hole, filled it up, and retiled the floor. It did not take long for the police to locate Fred Fulford. Guess what state he was in? Let's all say it together, shall we? Florida. Right. And now he lives in, let's all say it together, prison. Very good. Satan, sadist indeed. Every news story at the time, this was 1995, had the same lazy angle. It was like something out of one of his own movies. It's too bad that, like his movies, you couldn't go back and change it. The documentary Blood and Flesh, The Real Life and Ghastly Death of Al Adamson, was directed by David Gregory, who made the excellent Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Lost Souls. And it was released last year by Severn Films. It's on iTunes, or you can pick up the DVD at Amazon. If you do, why not visit Amazon through our click-through at danagould.com? You get what you need, and for no extra charge, we get kicked a couple of shekels right here to keep the lights on. And that's a few cents that Jeff Bezos doesn't get. How about that? The Al Adamson and Sam Sherman filmography has been remastered and is now available in a DVD box set that no film nerd can be without. There's a great book about Sam written by David Kanau. I hope I pronounced that correctly. It was written in 1998 called Schlockerama. I recommend it. You can still find that on Alibris or at Amazon. And as I said, as the COVID-19 lockdown has led to a resurgence in drive-ins, Sam Sherman, still alive and kicking, has been offering his films to pop-ups and drive-ins for a new generation to enjoy. God love you, Sam. Al Adamson, Ed Wood in Pants. Think about it.
Please remember to replace the speaker on the post when you leave the theater.
It's 1 minute till showtime.
I love you, Dana Gould. That's all I got to say.
And you, Eddie Pepitone.
Yeah.
You guys are cool.
We're cool because you're cool.
That Texas Blood tells the story of a well-meaning Texas sheriff, good guy, nearing retirement, haunted by the past, and as someone says to him, I'll just say this. In the first issue, a guy with a gaping chest wound looks at him, smiles, and says, "Sometimes you can't help but walk into a dirty deed." My kind of story. Please welcome my good buddy, Chris Condon.
This is the sound of my voice.
So now, Chris, we met a couple of years ago. You're a fellow traveler.
Indeed.
Could pick Forrest Ackerman out of a lineup.
Indeed, yeah.
I'm sure someone has at some point.
Well, yeah. So
when I met you, you were working for Joe Dante.
Yeah. So I was putting together some gallery / screenings. There were in conjunction. I would do a screening first beforehand, double feature. The first one that I did was Roger Corman and Joe Dante, and we did a double feature of Mask of the Red Death and Matinee, which is an odd double feature. But
I was at that double feature.
You were, and you did the Q&A for me.
I did the Q&A,
and that's how we met.
Was that
originally?
How we met?
Yeah.
I thought we met through Scott and Larry.
No, we met doing that because what happened was I thought to myself, I don't want to do the Q&A. Who would be good? And then I reached out to your agent, who then got in touch with me.
Oh, wow. No, I can't remember that.
Yeah.
Because you're one of those
people.
Yeah, I was one of those people. We met, and it's just like, was there, did I not know you at a certain time? From where are you from originally?
Well, I'm from a small town in New Jersey.
Okay, you're not from Texas.
I'm not.
Okay. Where in Jersey?
So I'm from central New Jersey, which some people say does not exist. I am one of the people that says that it does exist.
Where is it? What town?
So there is, well, if you're familiar with the great thief, Thomas Edison, I am literally inside of the town named after him.
Okay.
My town is surrounded by Edison.
Are you near Rockaway, New Jersey, and or Bergen County?
Bergen? No, not exactly.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's my only exposure to New Jersey.
That's a little further north.
Okay. So my ex-wife was from?
15 minutes from Staten Island.
Okay.
That's where I'm from.
You're very close to where Eddie Pepitone is from.
Oh.
He's a Staten Island.
Well, there you go.
Staten Island boy. And you went into, did you go to film school?
So, yeah, I went to film school, college out in Burbank called Woodbury University. That's what brought me out to California. Well, I knew I wanted to come out to California anyway. I always knew that I wanted to come out to California.
Right.
Wanted to make movies.
The businesses.
Well, it's movies, you know. It's like it's seeped in your blood when you're
sure.
out here. You drive by something and it's like, oh, that's from that movie. Or, you know, you're driving
yes.
up to the Griffith Observatory and you're like, oh, that's from, Back to the Future 2.
Right.
You know, it's just,
I was going to say Rebel Without a Cause, but yeah,
well,
Back to the
Future 2. Also Rebel Without a Cause.
But no, it's just saying, yeah, your cultural palette is movies as is mine. Yeah.
Yeah. So, right. I mean, I grew up watching movies. I grew up just like, so I would, my first job that I had, it was cash. I would just get paid cash.
Right.
I helped in a music wholesale business in some guy's basement in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. And he would pay me like $90 cash for the day. And I would go home. I would walk on the train
What would
tracks.
You do?
Well, so I would basically
it
just
sounds
stock
nefarious.
Things.
Oh, okay.
And then
making $90 a day in a strange guy's basement.
Yeah,
has
it was
a,
weird.
Has a big
I used a
inference.
Lot of, well, I used a lot of that time to just like, you know, write my own stuff because I would finish the job that they gave me to do very quickly, and then I would just write.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
But then, so I would just take that money that I made. I would walk to the Suncoast on the train track. So I would walk to the Suncoast. I'd buy DVDs. I would take those DVDs home. I'd watch them. Then I would listen to the commentary with the filmmaker. Then I would go out and find the that movie that that filmmaker was talking about, what inspired right. them. And that was how I kind of
yeah, you can go to film school pretty easily now. That's the problem with there being no video stores is that you're less inclined to stumble across something
yeah.
that you should know that otherwise, you know, the problem with having all of your entertainment come from a menu
yeah.
is that you're not exposed to stuff that you wouldn't otherwise know about.
Well, I'm also terrible with Netflix because I will literally sit with Netflix on and I will just scroll through for an hour instead of picking one thing. I'll go in thinking like, I'm going to watch this and then I'll see something else and go, oh, maybe I should watch that. And so I just scroll through right. indefinitely.
But they don't, and the DVD extras and the commentary tracks.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, those things are brilliant. I mean, that's,
but
that's,
you don't have them on Netflix.
No,
do you?
Yeah, no.
That's the that I also miss that.
Well, I mean, luckily there are in Los Angeles. There are some film stores out there, or video yeah. stores still out there. Cinephile is a great one.
I think. I was talking about this morning. I think all of that stuff. You know, there will always be bookstores.
Yeah,
but it's just you've got to look a little harder.
It's never going to be Fahrenheit 451.
No, but because that would take too much work. People are too lazy. That's the only reason. But it's also just more of a, it becomes more of a specialty thing.
Yeah.
You know.
But yeah, so that was kind of how I right. just came
in.
And
you come out here and you're working and you start to work for Joe Dante.
Yeah, so I cold called. I got an internship with him when I was in film school.
What was it about Joe Dante that made you want to work for him?
I think the first film of his that I saw was not Gremlins. It was The Howling.
Uh-huh.
I think that was the one that did it for me. And
right.
for me, the satiric level of that was just brilliant to me. I loved it. I loved how it was like a self-help satire.
Uh-huh.
I loved all the wolf chili jokes throughout it.
Right.
And I just sort of gravitated towards him as a filmmaker, like fell in love with his films. And he was one of my favorite filmmakers just from that.
And supposedly, and you would know this, you know, Dante is one of the kings of 80s cinema.
Yeah.
And, you know, now with Stranger Things, like now he's,
well, it's like Explorers, like Stranger Things.
Yeah, but he created, he's one of the architects of that entire sort of pop cultural look and language and tone.
Yeah.
That now is fondly, that's now nostalgic.
Well,
it's now nostalgia when actually I remember it firsthand.
Yeah.
But did you... I know that Gremlins specifically was originally just a horror movie.
Yeah.
It was a lot darker, was it?
And that would have been a crazy movie to see. Apparently, there was a scene where the mom got her head chopped off. It was thrown down the stairs. I believe the dog was also murdered. The dog in the movie is just strung up by the lights, but apparently the dog was like hung up by a noose or something like that.
Yeah, and now it's just the mother fights a tree.
Yeah. Which is pretty great. That's pretty great. I think that it's the greatest use of what's the name of that song? The can't you hear what I or do you hear what I hear?
Oh yeah,
the,
yeah.
The
yeah.
song. Like that is a brilliant scene. That's what I mean about Joe. I mean, I half of that.
Yeah,
stuff
he's funny. He's funny. He's darkly funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Matinee is one of those underrated gems. Like I have, you know, Matinee is. I put it in the same shopping basket with Ed Wood.
Well, I kind of wish that we had done like a double feature at some point of Matinee and Ed Wood.
Yeah.
Those two movies are, first of all, I mean, they're two movies that you watch and they make you want to make movies.
Yes. And they're movies that love movies.
Yeah. Also, yeah. I mean.
And they're movies that love movies that don't have to be great.
Yeah. I think that's the big thing is that it's, you can do this too.
Yeah.
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 It's just people that love the thing, and it doesn't matter if it's not good. It's the love of the work. It's the passion for the work.
Yeah, and there's so many. I remember seeing Matinee when it came out. I was in Texas on the road. I went alone on the Friday. You know, you're alone on the road. It was the early 90s. I was in Addison, Texas, and it came out, and I went. I couldn't wait to see it because, you know, I was still the same person I am now. I had all the same interests, and I knew it was basically about William Castle. And I was like, I got to see this.
Yeah.
And then Mant destroyed me, especially the – and I was the – you know, Friday matinee, no one in the theater. And he goes, hey, life isn't a picnic. Get it? Ants? Picnic? You see what I did there? I was just like, this movie is made – it was like, this movie was made for me.
Oh, yeah.
How are they going to make money?
my favorite line from it is, insecticide, where?
Really great.
But yeah, that movie is just, it's brilliant. And I love that movie. I think that might be my favorite Joe Dante movie, actually.
It's mine, yeah.
But yeah, he's in a level of his own. It's Spielberg tends to get the credit. Nothing against Spielberg. We're great and influential. Yeah. But Joe's aesthetic is the thing that you see on screen in Stranger Things.
But you wanted to make movies, and you had this idea for a short film.
Yeah.
About a corrupt...
Yeah.
What was the genesis of this? Because we met, we're friends, we're both, you know, movie nerds, and you found a workaround.
Yeah.
And it's sort of... Yeah, but it's also the way the business... As a vol, you know, we're the theme of, you know, a lot of the conversations that I've been having lately, certainly on this podcast, is we're in the middle of a revolution.
Yeah.
Not in terms of, in terms of everything, but specifically, show business is turning itself inside out. Nobody really knows how it's going to shake out.
Yeah.
And one of the ways to get something made now is if it's already they call an IP. Intellectual property. The best example of the story is Larry Doyle, who was a writer on The Simpsons. And Larry wrote a screenplay about two kids, and it's like a kid's first crush. And I don't know, it was like, I love you something, the girl's name. I love you, Mary Smith, although it's something else. Wrote it as a movie, nobody made it. Nobody bought it. Adapted his script as a novel, got the novel published. And then one of the companies that passed on the script hired him to adapt his novel because it was a novel. Somebody else liked it. Now I like it.
It's crazy. It's a crazy industry, the way that things work out. But yeah, that was pretty much the same thing. I wrote – so it was actually – the idea for the short film initially was sort of the whiplash idea of like, let's make a short film that's a part of a bigger thing. So it was a feature script. And instead of doing a section of the feature film – as a short film, I decided that it might be kind of cool to do sort of like a prologue, which is where the initial title came from. Originally, it was called Passive Prologue, which a little like highfalutin.
That title is bad enough to have been thought up by me.
But so we ended up obviously ditching that for the more pulpy, I think, better title, That Texas Blood.
Yeah. Which is a great title.
Which was the title of a story arc in the comic.
Uh-huh.
And so we just kind of borrowed that and gave that to the, the actual series. But yeah, so the genesis was this short film. I was like, I'd want to introduce like a kind of side character in this feature. And that was the Sheriff Joe Bob Coates, who is a character that I love. He's named after a guy that I actually know from Texas. So that's actually another thing. So I'm not from Texas. I'm from New Jersey. But I have a good friend that I met out here. His name is Malcolm Duncan. He's a music video producer. He's from West Texas. He's from Marfa, Texas.
Oh, yeah, Marfa, sure.
And so I met him, met his family, spent a lot of time with them, and sort of by osmosis
it's another country.
Became like a Texan.
Sure.
In
a way. And well, in Texas is another country.
Yeah. And then so the first time I visited, I remember driving through the border and just seeing like, I don't know how many state troopers just pulling people over, and like it looked like almost like a police state.
Yeah.
But, and then this sort of sounds like I'm like talking down on Texas, but I actually love
No,
Texas.
It's just different. It's just...
Texas is just, it's such an interesting place, and it's so ripe for stories. I think that there's something about it that's almost like the Final Frontier. I mean,
yeah, it is
space.
It's
Texas.
It's Mos Eisley.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like anything goes. It's like so it's like really ripe for the first couple issues of the comic are going to be crime, pretty much. Right. There's going to be little elements here and there of like kind of horror.
But how did you end up? Did you write it as a? You didn't make the short. You didn't write
we
the.
Didn't make the short. Yeah. Because we couldn't get the money for it. It was going to be expensive. You shoot it down in Texas. Yada yada. Just couldn't find the funding for it. And so I had actually originally contacted my artist, Jacob Phillips, who is the son of an Eisner Award-winning artist, Sean Phillips.
Okay, I certainly know Sean
Phillips. Who draws Criminal. Right. Now Jacob does the colors for it. But he was originally doing the backups for this comic series called Kill or Be Killed, which Ed Brubaker was writing, Sean Phillips was drawing. There would always be a film essay in the back about whether it's noir or whatever. He would do the drawings in the back, and I really liked his stuff, and I needed somebody to do concept art for me to try and pitch it.
Right.
Because I wasn't getting anywhere with it just as a script. I was like, maybe if I have something visual, maybe then we can sell it a little bit better. So he did four pieces of concept art, and they were fantastic pieces of concept art. Again, just still couldn't get the funding together, and after a year of trying to get the funding together, I just said, screw it, Jake, do you want to do this as a comic book?
Interest. So you just, no one came to you with the idea.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just frustration on my part.
Right.
It's just, you know, instead of just sitting around and saying, you know, I'm trying to make this thing, you know, I actually was like, let's just do it. So
smartest decision you've ever made.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool to actually just see essentially the storyboards for what the film would have been.
Yeah, and could be like in reading the first issue of that Texas Blood.
Yeah.
I imagined. Like, if you got this to, you know, the guy that I thought of was Jack Nicholson, although he's retired now, but whoever the Jack Nicholson of today is, you know, they would read this and go like, oh, I see this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to do this movie. You know who could kill this? Harrison Ford.
Yeah. He was definitely like, if that was ever a possibility, I would have loved to have gotten him.
Yeah.
I always pick was Sam Neill. I just thought Sam Neill would have been good.
Yeah,
but yeah. So I
and so you're like me. Like, what about somebody with less notoriety? What about somebody less famous?
Well, so
who would bring fewer people to it?
Right. Well, so like, here's the thing. So I know that your friend
Don Murray would be.
Jeffrey Combs is my favorite actor.
Well, that's so funny.
He is. Yeah,
I am friends with him now.
I see him in anything. It doesn't matter. It can be, and he'll probably admit this. He has been in some not exactly stellar films.
He's a working actor.
Exactly. And I will watch anything that he's
great.
In because he is a scene stealer. He's fantastic in whatever he's in.
Yeah.
His Edgar Allan Poe is fantastic.
It's amazing. We were at dinner, Jeffrey Combs, my girlfriend, some other people, myself. My girlfriend... knows the Raven front to back, and she and Jeffrey both recited the Raven in stereo at dinner all the way through. It was like other tables were like looking because it's long ass goddamn poem.
I hope that they applauded at the end.
They did. I have it on video. I'll post it onto the Patreon. I'll show you after. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no, Jeffrey's great. He would be terrific in this.
It was one of
Harrison Ford, I like that he's still working.
Yeah, same. He's one of the highlights of the new Star Wars movie. Literally that.
His first Star Wars movie I did not see.
I don't want to influence your opinion. I did not like it.
It's been made. No, you're not the only person that has said that.
I know. Aware. It's just, I don't know what happened to it. It's a failure, in my opinion, of it's supposed to end the series. It's supposed to be the Skywalker series, the Skywalker saga, and it doesn't end it in a satisfying at all way.
Well, the entire, not to go down in this rabbit hole too deeply, but Star Wars Empire, Return of the Jedi, told the story of the ascension of this guy and the fall of the Empire. I don't know what story the second trilogy is telling. The end of the second movie, at the end of The Empire Strikes Back, it's the villain is my father. I have had my hand cut off, and the Empire is crushing us. And the end of the second movie in this trilogy is, I don't think we have any friends.
Here's my problem with it is, so if you watch the original trilogy, the characters always progress film to film.
Yes.
They're in a different place at the beginning of every film. In the beginning of Return of the Jedi, Luke has his black suit on. He's actually he's like force choking people.
Yeah.
He's learned new things. Everybody's learned new things.
Yeah.
In this, literally, you wind up with the characters at exactly the same spots throughout the trilogy. So, like, you start off in this Rise of Skywalker with Rey in exactly the same spot that she was in. She still hasn't mastered anything. She can barely, you know, like, make anything float. She hasn't progressed anywhere.
Yeah.
I would have loved it to have seen her actually be somebody. I'm lost.
And know? I don't know. Yeah.
Which I think it's a shame because I feel like they really, like, in the very first one, The Force Awakens, I felt like they kind of, like, were, like, setting it up. Like, it could go interesting places, and I don't think that it really ended up going anywhere.
To the best of my memory, no one did anything in the second movie.
Yeah.
We spent time with Luke Skywalker.
You could argue that happens in Empire, too.
Then he died, and then Rey got in a fight that I knew she was going to win, and I don't know what else happened.
Yeah. Well, I honestly think that I just don't think that we should – not that we shouldn't, but I just don't think that we need Star Wars movies, I think, is actually the thing.
Well, the lie that has been revealed in all of this is there was no grand design ever. He wrote,
which is why the first three are great,
right?
That there's
but
no
even
design,
right? And even the second one, they, you know, so George,
I wrote 27 films and decided to use the 17th as the first movie.
Yeah,
horseshit. You wrote one movie and then it became a crazy success, and then you had to go back and retrofit all of this malarkey about this grand Tolkien-esque design, which was never there, which is why all of the movies are just remakes of each other. It's why they keep blowing up the Death Star. It's why they keep cross-cutting a sword fight with a land battle. It's because they don't have an overarching story, which is fine. Just don't say you do.
Yeah. No, yeah, he's always said that. And, like, the thing is,
and he also said, I'm waiting to make small experimental films.
Oh, yeah.
What are you waiting for? To have the money to do it?
Like, yeah, I mean, and that's kind of – and he always said, like, oh, but I'm not going to release them to the public or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, so then why are you going to make them anyway?
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, so the whole thing with the original Star Wars movie, he says that he had this, like, gigantic script and he pared it down and he just decided to film the one act.
Right.
And that was the first Star Wars movie in
1977.
Except when he had Alan Dean Foster write Splinter of the Mind's Eye, the novel, that was going to be – the idea of that novel was that they were going to adapt that novel into –
the
second Star Wars film, if anybody liked it.
Right.
So he had no clue of what
Empire
was.
He had no idea
where
he was going.
But, you know, whatever.
No clue. George Lucas, right. And obviously it's like, we can't blow up the Death Star. What's a big thing? What if Darth Vader was Luke's dad? Oh, I like it.
But that's, I don't know.
I will bet you my eye teeth that's happened. I will bet you my eye teeth. He did not sit down with, was it Lee Brackett? And go like, well, here's all I know. Darth is Luke's dad. No, he's not.
Well,
I don't buy it.
I mean, you know, I do appreciate George Lucas, though, as a filmmaker. I mean,
sure, he's great. He's great. And I just don't understand why you have to keep shoveling this same line of horseshit and how, and I don't know, like with a megalopolis like Disney, you could ever make anything interesting.
Well, I remember,
because I'm sure I would bet, I'm sure J.J. Abrams, he's a good filmmaker. He, you know, he's competent. He had some ideas and like, I don't know. Is there a toy to that? What if everything kind of, here's the one thing that never happens at Disneyland. You have a great time. You're never surprised.
Yeah.
By anything or challenged by anything.
Which is these Star Wars films.
Right. You know, these are the cinematic equivalent of the food at Disneyland.
Yeah.
This will be palatable to everybody. It will be no one's favorite meal.
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking to a friend and just going over what, you know, because you watch a Star Wars movie, you're like, oh, I wish that I had seen this. I wish that I had seen this. I wish that I had seen this. And them going, well, but this is a Disney movie. And I was like, that's the problem. Is that it's a Disney movie, so they play everything too safe.
Yeah.
Because it's, I mean, in the original film, Star Wars, the actual Star Wars, which I call Star Wars, I don't call it A New Hope.
No one calls it A New Hope.
But in the original Star Wars, the one guy gets his arm cut off in the cantina, and it's bloody.
Yeah,
it's like, and I mean, the whole thing where the whole thing was apparently like an allegory for the Vietnamese. The rebels are the Vietnamese, and the Empire is the Americans.
No, that tracks.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, that's cool. And then what is this one?
I don't know.
It's hollow, you know? Well, it doesn't have the...
Yeah, I mean, we're Monday morning quarterbacking this.
Yeah.
I was surprised. The Force Awakens was either a stroke of genius or an act of cowardice because it was just a remake.
Yeah.
And it was either like, we need you to remake Star Wars in a way that people don't realize that it's a remake. And that will sort of reboot this system. If that was the goal, they're geniuses. Or it was just like, we need to continue the Star Wars movie. Right? What do you like about Star Wars? A, B, C. Great, do that again. There's an empire. The empire's defeated. Yeah, there's a new empire.
Yeah.
And there's a rebellion. But the last time the rebellion was on top. Yeah, now they're on the bottom again. You know, it's all the same. Kylo Ren, he had a helmet. Didn't really. They just got. It seems to me that they just got rid of the helmet.
Yeah.
I didn't see the third one, but he had a Darth Vader-y helmet.
Back.
And they just got rid of it.
A friend of mine said something. They were like, oh, well, he should have just remolded Vader's helmet. So to put Vader's helmet on in the third film. And I was like, that would have been cool. So it's like everybody has like a better idea than what is actually in this film.
Yeah. And then they made change. Like they redesigned the stormtroopers.
Yeah.
The stormtroopers were a brilliant, iconic design. What do you like about the new ones? They're just a little bit worse than the thing that I liked.
They're the Apple version of.
But they're terrible.
Yeah.
They're not as good. It's nothing about it is as good.
Well,
they're gonna keep
making them until
they will keep making them and God love them. I hope that. But then you always see stuff that surprises you. That it's great that Disney doesn't own everything.
Yeah.
They almost do, but I thought The Watchmen was fantastic.
Oh, me too.
And I'm glad
they're not making a second
season.
And that
was euphoric to hear they weren't making a second.
Yeah.
No, this is what we're doing.
Oh, I thought that was a brilliant show.
Yeah, I thought it was so great. It made me so happy. And and that's it, and we're done.
Yeah.
And I like that in that regard, American show business is moving more towards the British style, which is like, we came up with this idea, there's eight of them, and then it's it. You know, like The Singing Detective, which is arguable, in its day, the Michael Gambon miniseries, The Singing Detective, which was remade as a bad movie starring Robert Downey Jr. in the early aughts. But the original Michael Gambon Singing Detective, written by Dennis Potter, in its day, was the greatest thing that had ever been on television.
Yeah.
Like there were things that were as good. There was nothing better. And in America, it would have been, well, what's season two? Nope, this is it. It's six episodes or whatever it was. We told this story, and now that story is over. I like that one of the things with the sort of shattering of how entertainment is delivered, and by shattering, I mean everything is now a small piece that you like. Do you like DC? Do you like DC comics? Great. Well, there's a network. So any show that you want with a DC character is on the DC character network.
Everything is branded in this particular way for the particular
bifurcated and fucked to death.
Yeah. Well, NBC's coming out with their own streaming service.
They have Peacock. To. Oh, is that the name of it?
They're calling it the Peacock, yeah.
Well, I know they had a meeting. It has to have cock in the title. Whatever else you say.
But yeah,
it's terrible title. I know it's the mascot of the network, but I don't care. It's a terrible title. And the only reason it's Peacock is because NBC used to be owned by RCA and they were selling color televisions. Yeah. Well, Peacocks are very colorful. That's why Star Trek stayed on the air. One of the things that contributed to Star Trek staying on the air when its numbers weren't valued, that it was one of the highest rated color shows.
Yeah.
And RCA was trying to get people to buy color televisions. So the more colorful the TV shows were, the more people felt, oh God, we got to get rid of this black and white set. We got to buy a color TV set.
And that show has some of the most insane lighting.
It's beautiful.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's just purple, red. Yeah.
I was talking about this. Yeah. Talking about that yesterday. If you ever saw the show, have you ever seen Star Trek Continued?
No.
It's amazing. And one of the actors is going to be on this show. It was a fan produced streaming.
Oh, is that the one that they would get like George Takei in?
Yes.
Okay. I think I've heard of it. I've never seen it though. But
watch them. They're amazing.
Yeah.
They look like shows from 1967. The lighting, the film grain, the wardrobe. They're great. They're well written. I said written like Karina Longworth. They're well written. And the actor who plays Kirk, who is also the guy that is sort of the exec producer of the whole shebang, he plays Kirk without playing Shatner, which is it's great. No, they're very enjoyable. They're really well done. I think once Discovery started and CBS started streaming Star Trek, they finally put a gun in their mouth because they were doing it with tacit permission for a while.
Yeah.
And then I think they finally got
I remember hearing about some big lawsuit or something.
Well, I think they were doing it with the permission of Paramount. It was like, as long as you don't make any money off this, you can do it. And there was a Patreon or something, but it was just to pay for the new episodes. But then I think when they started making their own TV series, they were like, no, we don't want to be competing with ourselves.
Was that when Discovery was going to come out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and then I discovered that I didn't enjoy it.
Well, did you watch the new Picard?
No, I got CBS All Access to watch Discovery. Gave it like 5 or 6 episodes.
That's the only thing that you would watch.
It was the only thing I would watch. It was like, oh, Cagney and Lacey, any episode I want. I gave Discovery and then it just became homework. Like, I'm not enjoying this. It's not Star Trek. It's not fun. It's not hopeful. Yeah, and I was just like, I heard it get better when they brought in Christopher Pike.
It does get better. I watched the entirety of it. I liked the second season a whole lot more.
Yeah.
The first season is tedious, but it's still.
And they just want to make it. They just wanted to make it Game of Thrones in outer space.
Yeah.
It's just like, we're going to bring in characters that you like and then we're going to kill them. We're going to have, you know, it's everybody's a jerk. It just didn't feel like Star Trek to me. And Star Trek does especially in this time when we're living in Soylent Green, it's nice to have something that's hopeful and that reassures you. It's no, we're going to make it out of this. We're going to make it out of this. And there'll be challenges, but people at their essence are decent.
Yeah.
And that is what, to me, Star Trek was about at its best, which is at the end of the day, people are decent and that the decent people will win out. Humans are crazy, and I think we're getting
yarn in Kansas. It's just like,
everyone
what?
Says that they are witnessing the fall of civilization, but I really think I am. And we were apes, and we are primal, and we have a dark side to all of us, and there is violence in everyone, psychic, emotional, physical, however it manifests. And the more people, the people are under pressure, and the more people are under pressure, the more that comes out. I'm fascinated by what it is about the design of Twitter that makes everyone on it
an asshole.
An asshole.
Yeah, I don't know.
It has something to do with the same reason people go crazy when they wear a mask. It's like you're apart from yourself. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is.
There's this show. It's like a sort of kind of Broadway show, but it's a 3 or 4 story building in New York City. They do a performance that's on every floor. It's based on Macbeth.
I've heard about this. Like, yeah, it's sort of interactive.
Like, yeah, but they're putting on a performance. You're walking around. You're wearing a mask. Right. And apparently, a lot of the customers would find that as an excuse that, I can touch this person because they're naked. And so people would be, you know, sexually assaulted because these people are wearing masks, because these people are anonymous. So as soon as they put on a mask, they become this anonymous person. They feel like they can do anything.
Yeah.
And honestly, that was I'm not a fan of the character of Deadpool, the Marvel character.
Right.
The movies are fine, whatever. But I'm not a fan of him, and I'll tell you why. It has nothing to do with the creator. It has nothing to do with the comics. It has nothing to do with any of that. It's that when I would go to a comic convention, and I would see guys dressed like Deadpool, and they would find that character's snark and the mask and the way that he acts in the comic, they would find that as an excuse that they could sexually harass people or they could sexually assault people.
Be a dick.
Because they're being funny.
Right.
Because they're being Deadpool. And it's like, no, you're a man or a woman who is just wearing a costume, pretending to be this fictional character. You are not that person. You can't do that.
And it goes to something that I've noticed too. It's the rise of bully comedy, but I put comedy in quotes. Kobe Bryant passed away, died in a helicopter.
Yeah.
Some quote comedians unquote went right at the fact that he was accused of rape, and that was the only thing about him that mattered, and nothing else mattered, and that and you know, one guy, I won't mention his name, but looks like he might have blackjacked his career for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And in his apology, he said, "Look, I'm a comedian. When somebody famous dies, I say something shitty. My fans come to expect it." You know, the whole thing that like you say the quiet part out loud.
Yeah.
It's like, you're a comedian. You're supposed to say something funny. Why is saying, when did shitty become equitable
to funny?
To funny.
Yeah.
When did being an asshole become the new clever? It's like, you're not clever. You're just being an asshole. Anybody can be an asshole. It takes talent and skill to be clever. It's lazy.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. This whole Todd Phillips thing with the Joker, and when he was doing the press tour, he was saying, you know, you can't be funny anymore.
Yeah.
Because you have to, you can't be.
Because you have to try.
Be PC, he says.
Because you have to try.
I mean, there was that new Dave Chappelle's special, and he wasn't PC at all in it, you know. And so he,
no, you can be funny, yeah.
You could still do.
You can be funny.
Yeah, so.
You can be funny.
That movie's another thing, but that's the culture that we live in now, is that people are just putting up these guards. They're just putting on this armor against the world, and it's just like it's becoming just a constant clash.
Yeah, and just because you don't necessarily like quote PC culture unquote, it doesn't mean that the opposite is any better.
Yeah,
you know, as in all things, probably somewhere in the middle ground is where you want to be.
Yeah.
The fun of being a writer is that you get an idea and then you make crap.
Yeah. It's honestly the best job because you're able to just sit there with the blank page is just, I don't know.
Yeah. It's you get to do it in your house.
Yeah, you get to sit in your chair.
Yeah, it's great. It's my favorite times are when you're just like, you get everything set away, and like, I got 3 hours, I can just kind of, and it's horribly difficult to start.
Well, I think it's hard to write in general, though, actually.
Yeah, well, which who wants to? It's effort. But once you get into it, it's like, it's good, but you got to start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes I remember.
It's like going to the gym. You don't want to do it, and then you start, and you're okay.
Well, I remember way back in some writer's workshop that I took. I don't remember when it was, but I remember the teacher telling me, like, you get to this point after 3 paragraphs, if you need to write these three paragraphs before to get to that point, good, but you don't need these three paragraphs.
Yeah, then you throw them away.
So it's just, it's the me starting and then I'll hit my stride.
Yeah, yeah, at, absolutely. You know,
some,
you can
like,
feel
midway
it.
Point.
Yeah. It's called That Texas Blood on Image Comics.
Yeah, so it's going to be at your local comic shop. Tell your comic shop to order it.
From Image, they're a big company.
Yes, they are, I would say, probably the third largest comic book company, comic publisher. I would say it's DC Comics, Marvel, maybe Marvel first, obviously, and then Image Comics. So,
well, who knows? One day, maybe, I'm not sure, but if the stars align, a movie may be made that is based on a comic book character. Maybe.
Other podcasts reach for the sky. Dana Gould-bound.
We barely try.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by The Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano. Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I'm a DJ, I'm a DJ, I'm a person, I'm a person. I'm a singer, I love to sing and DJ. Boom! Pizza, pizza, you want me? Pizza.